RFK on your podcast today. Naomi Klein, author, activist, and increasingly admired and resented celebrity of the left. We talk about the media and her message. And Jamie Oliver, the Naked Chef, is a global food superstar. He's got a new book and a new TV series, and he's live in Studio Q. Plus, Montreal visual artist Marc Zagan makes risky art about post-9/11 fear. What's the reaction to his new show in the Big Apple? Well, we discuss No Logo Coup. This is Q. Well, Naomi Klein is probably the best known leftist author in the world right now, if not one of the best known writers, period, of any stripe. It all started with her international bestseller, No Logo, back in 2000. And this fall, she's been everywhere, all over North America and Europe, with her latest book, The Shock Doctrine, a bestseller here and in Italy, Spain, and Germany. And that's meant a whole lot of print, radio, and TV interviews.
Naomi Klein, Naomi, how you doing?
Great.
I recognize that background well. You are in Amsterdam, which is great. I'm usually the only one who's high on the show. So let's talk about your book.
Let's talk about shock in the sense of torture. It's where you begin. Blank is beautiful. Talk about that.
Well, I start the book looking at these at the two laboratories.
You're saying that these dreadful capitalists, as it were, actually planned the events in order to clean up afterwards, or that they just exercised opportunism after the event?
I think it's the latter. I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
These dreadful capitalists, as it were.
That was Al Jazeera. This is so meta. I can't believe this.
That was Bill Maher, Amy Goodman, and Robert Frost. That's the, you know, getting that kind of media attention is no small feat. The Shock Doctrine is Naomi Klein's in-depth look at the connections between issues such as torture, disaster, global economics, and shock. But with that one small phrase, disaster capitalism, Naomi Klein has been able to bring a heavy, complex topic to a mass audience. As an author, journalist, documentary filmmaker, Naomi Klein has become very skilled at working with the mainstream media, it would seem. We've been talking a lot about the relationship between public profile and politics these days on Q, so we thought we'd get Naomi's take on what it's like to be the so-called celebrity of the left and how she uses the media and mediums to advance her message. Naomi Klein, as you might have heard, joins me now live in Studio Q. Hello.
Hi. That was really weird.
What does it mean, meta? I think I know what it means.
Interviews about interviews.
Oh, yes.
Interview collages, yeah.
Well, but partly because you really have been around the world, or at least predominantly through Europe and North America. We wanted to get you on about the book a couple of months ago, and then now we're thinking, let's get you on about the book tour, because it's interesting in and of itself. First of all, how's it been going?
Yeah, no, it has been really interesting, and it's been weird. I mean, it's weird to write a book that's critical of a sort of homogenizing economic model. And it's precisely because this economic model is homogenizing and has sort of has conquered the world in a sort of one-size-fits-all model that a critique of it is also global. And, you know, but there's definitely something weird about being this simultaneously published in eight languages, and just kind of feeling a little bit like I am what I'm critiquing. And so as I've traveled with the book, I've used each new place as an opportunity to really test the thesis and think before I go, okay, what does this theory mean in Germany? What does it mean in Italy?
And really indigenous culture.
And doing a whole new wave of additional research so that I can win arguments with right-wingers in all these countries.
Okay, well, first of all, let me just pick up on when you say the fear that you are what you are critiquing. Specifically, what does that mean?
Well, just in the sense of being an English language writer being translated into other countries, other languages. And, you know, there is a way in which, even though, you know, I'm a Canadian, not American, that it felt a little bit like kind of importing this North American.
So it feels top down?
Well, it feels like vaguely culturally imperialist, actually, at times.
Very
right?
Top down.
Yeah. And it's just really complicated terrain. No Logo was a lot more straightforward, because it was really about a bunch of companies that had that were in all these countries, and everybody was talking about.
I guess I want to know if when you this time around, and it's not like you've only done these two books. You know, there's a book in between. There's a movie, The Take. There's a lot that you've been doing, but given that No Logo was the first major foray internationally, you know, I wonder if you learned anything from the interviews you were doing at the time that you apply now. Okay, I'm not going to do what I did when I was doing No Logo, or I am going to do this in terms of actually this process, like this one right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think with No Logo, I was really bad at it. And a lot of it is just about confidence. I think when somebody fairly young gets catapulted to that position, particularly in the, nonfiction book world politics, where you're suddenly put in a position of being an expert on the economy and lecturing people many years older than you, it's really hard not to feel illegitimate in that role. And the nervousness is that, okay, they're going to find me out. I really don't know what I'm doing, right? I mean, and I think that anybody who's just not outrageously arrogant their first time out is battling those feelings of, I don't really belong here and I don't have all the answers. And so I think with this book, a lot of that nervousness is gone. But also, it was the kind of overwhelming response to No Logo that made me decide to just drop out of the public sphere for like 4 years to produce this book, the research that was required, the travel, and then just 2 straight years of writing and reading. And I did that because I just saw what happens to people who just stay on this grind of going from sort of speech to speech.
And what's that?
They just repeat themselves. And whatever it is that made people inspired in the first place, which was a freshness of a perspective and a newness to the ideas, is lost. And it takes a level of discipline. And I think this is true for artists. It's true for musicians, because there is this, as you know, there's the demand to just keep doing what it is that you've been doing, and you can keep touring. And the fact is, politics is no different.
At some point, you got to write the next record.
Yeah. And it is like that, right? And so at this point, I think the reason why I'm more confident, it's a combination of being more practiced at it, but also just knowing I have something new to say now.
What have you learned about selling, speaking about, identifying a complex issue and argument and message in a soundbite world? It occurs to me reading The Shock Doctrine that, you know, even 25 years ago, John Kenneth Galbraith comes out with a book. He's not necessarily competing with ADD television that we have now, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the quickest way you do it is you start with what people already know, in terms of, you know, you don't try to introduce a whole new set of ideas, because that takes too much time. So there has to be shorthand. So even though the book is an alternative history of the past 50 years, you start with the most recent examples that you can go shorthand with. Remember Katrina? Remember the levees broke? Well, the housing projects are still closed. The school system has been turned into a private system. And people have images in their head, and you're not giving them wholly new information. And so you start with where people are at, where their heads are at, an example they get, and then you broaden it out and apply the thesis if you've got time.
Do snappy phrases like the shock doctrine or disaster capitalism help? Is that part of?
You know, I think that's
the insidious agenda. Is that an easy way to sell things? Is that something you really work at? How do I say this in two words?
Well, I think that I'm a journalist and an opinion writer, and as anybody with experience working, you know, my background's in magazines and newspaper writing, so we're constantly thinking about new ways to frame an idea, and catchy phrases are just part of what we do. And you know, I wrote headlines for a while in magazines and newspapers, and playing with words and playing with language. But I think inevitably a lot of the ideas are not entirely new. I mean, a critique of the violence embedded in a market system is something Marx was on about some years back, but you know, that you've got a couple of choices. You either just repeat yourself for a few hundred years, or you find new framings and ways that allow people to look at something that they think they already understand. But language, if the language feels new and the language has an aha and a click, then it can break down the barriers that we have that go up when we think when we hear jargon, when we hear a certain type of language that we have learned to dismiss. So you just need to renew the language.
Do you worry about walking the line, though, of oversimplifying the message when you have a snappy, when you have jargon?
Well, I have a 600-page book, so I feel like, you know, if I have to do a little bit of oversimplifying to get people to read that 600-page book, I can live with that.
I want to get back to you and how what it's like to be you right now on this book tour, and you know, you're tagged in the media as a celebrity of the left. What do you think of that? How do you feel about that?
It's kind of a contradiction in terms. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, honestly, I feel like I've spent the past 3 months talking about ideas. It hasn't really been all that glamorous. I mean,
how do you balance what you believe in, democracy, pluralism, mm-hmm. non-hierarchical approach, with the media star status?
You know what? Honestly, Gian, like a lot of my dealing in the media is just me getting insulted by BBC reporters, you know. I mean, it's not like they're fawning. I go on these shows and I just, you know, with a couple of exceptions, generally just get insulted and do all I can to hang on for dear life.
You're pals with Bill Maher. That doesn't sound so bad.
Okay, Bill Maher was very nice. But no, I mean, I think that the media attention has been, you know, it's been combative and... I think as well it should be. Now, I know honestly, the answer to the question is that it's deeply unfair and I feel terribly guilty about it because, you know, I don't know why I'm being given this media access when so many other progressives who've written fantastic books get totally shut out. So the main way that I feel it is as a tremendous responsibility to use the space mm-hmm. to push it as far as I can push it.
It's an advantage at times, surely.
The celebrity thing?
Yeah. Well,
not sometimes, all the time.
Okay. And what about celebrity endorsements? I mean, there's blurbs from Tim Robbins and John Cusack on the Shock Doctrine. You laughing because you've been asked this before?
No.
All right.
No, I'm just laughing because you're just... No.
I'm surprising you by asking questions.
No.
How do you feel about the celebrity? You've got these endorsements alongside heavy intellects like Seymour Hersh and Howard Zinn. So how do you feel about that?
How do I feel about it? You know, I think Tim Robbins is somebody who I have a huge amount of respect for. I don't just see him as a celebrity. He is pushing the envelope in Hollywood. You know, he's been a real advocate for the book. It's not just an endorsement. Mm-hmm. He's the reason I was on Bill Maher. He called them up and said, you guys have to get her on, you know. Mm-hmm. He feels really passionately about it. And Cusack, you know, Cusack has also been doing whatever he can.
The thing is, you're getting defensive.
Get...
I'm not actually asking these questions to put you on defensive. I'm asking how you use John Cusack to sell...
I'm only laughing to y'all because if I were me listening to this interview, I would just think I was so obnoxious.
Why would you think you're obnoxious?
Because it's like it adds up. It's terrible.
Well,
no, I think it's funny.
When you know, in terms of the ideas campaign, I'll let you go soon. I swear. How do you measure success these days? How's Naomi Klein? I mean, I believe that this isn't just about. You wouldn't put yourself through all of this if it was just about selling books. And you do have a very fine scarf on, though. That you've been able to. That's a very nice scarf. But I don't believe it's about all that for you. How do you measure?
You don't
success?
Think it's about my scarf?
I don't think so. I think you got the. I think there's more. You do this for more than just the fancy
just the scarf. That's going to make people so curious.
It's a very nice sort of a reddish...
I often wear the scarf. Mm. It is about social change, and it's hard to talk about this without feeling hokey, but...
But like personally, do you sort of go, okay, you know, if I can just do this in this next year with this book, I'll be happy. What would that be? What's the...
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's trickiest actually is that people want more. And what's been surprising to me is actually how receptive people are to the critique and how it's like, okay, what do we do? And I struggle with that because, you know, I don't have the answers. But I also feel like there's a responsibility to being the person at the front of the room when the question, what do we do, gets asked. Mm-hmm. So in terms of what motivates me, it's just not to squander this moment, really, because I actually feel it's a very powerful political moment. And And I feel like anybody who has a platform, a media platform, or, you know, any kind of public platform, has a responsibility to live up to the moment. So that's I guess, a sort of weird answer, but it's just to sort of to not lose courage at a crucial moment.
Your measure of success is to keep going.
Yeah. Okay. I can go there.
See, I can put this in. There's your slogan. I'm just going to keep going. If anybody ever asks you that again, to keep going. That's. I think you said it more eloquently, but thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, y'all. It was fun, I think.
It was fun for me. Neil McLean is the author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It's published by Random House.